started today with Mike Scott. You're Canadian, is that correct?
Yes, I live in Canada.
Awesome.
Oh, very cool. East side or west side?
I'm central. I'm smack dab in the middle.
Is it cold up there?
Is it called Manitoba? Is that in my...
That's to the right of us, or hold on.
Okay, so I am, that name is...
Yeah, it's to the right. It was cold, like, every winter. I don't know, I was born and raised in this whole area, so I'm used to it, but anybody from, like, Arizona or Texas or, like, anywhere that's hot, if they come here, they'll freeze in the winter. You guys go by what, Celsius or Fahrenheit?
Most Americans go by Fahrenheit. I personally use Celsius because I spent a lot of time overseas. I lived in Russia and stuff like that. So what's the Celsius?
Like Celsius minus 50 sometimes with the wind chill.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah. That's cold.
That's like, the only time I was ever in weather like that was when I went to the Arctic Circle in Russia.
It gets really cold. And the really sad thing about that, too, is there's a lot of homeless people in Canada, and a lot of them suffer. Sometimes they can't even get into, like, shelters and stuff. So some years we have people who don't make it through the winter just because of how cold the conditions are.
Oh, my gosh. That's so sad.
It's terrible.
Not to start on such a sad note, but
it's real life. Totally.
Yeah, it is.
And sometimes what's really tough, even if they do get in a shelter, because there's too many people and not enough beds, they can't ever leave. Because if they leave, then someone else will take their beds. So they're like trapped. It's really heartbreaking. I'm in California, so it's warm here pretty much. And we get a lot of homeless people that come here for that reason. But even then, even sometimes in the winter, it gets real cold out there and they need blankets and things like that.
I went out to Hawaii about close to eight years ago for a conference. It was called WIPSI. It was like the World Indigenous People Conference. So it's like one of the biggest conferences in the world. And when I got to Hawaii, like, the weather is beautiful, right? It's Hawaii, obviously. But the homelessness that I noticed out there was, like, so high. And a lot of people go from the mainland to Hawaii because they have everything they need out there, right? Like, it'll never be cold. They don't have to worry about that. So, in Canada, we have, I think, Indigenous people probably make up the highest percentage of people that are living, you know, in poverty and that are homeless.
Yeah.
I'm in university now. I'm in my third year of Indigenous Studies. That's my major. And a lot of the classes that I take, I like to learn about the history of Canada and stuff like that. And the last paper that I wrote was in regards to homelessness, too. So it was pretty sad because I'm a part of that statistic. All the Indigenous population of Canada combined, we make up less than 5% of the entire population of Canada. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's about 33 million people-ish in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Less than 5% of them are Native American, Indigenous, all different tribes. There's Dene, Cree, Dakota. There's so many different tribes in Canada. We all combined make up less than 5%. But we make up the highest percent of people that are incarcerated in jails. We make up the highest percentage of people that are living in poverty, that are dealing with homelessness. We make up the highest percentage of the children that are in foster care.
Oh my gosh.
So compared to the rest of the races combined in Canada and us making up less than 5%, the numbers are pretty staggering. So when I read that, I was like triggered. I was like, man, that was me when I was a kid living in poverty with nothing to eat, ending up in foster care, ending up in jail. I know we can discuss more of that later, but
yeah,
pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah, seriously. When I was in Russia, we opened a center for homeless children and we got them back into school and fed them and clothed them. They would go down into the sewers. That's how they'd stay warm. Open little sewer grates and go and lay on the pipes.
Wow.
So, yeah, we'd go down there and find them and give them coats and clothes. And it's still running today. I'm really proud of that. Not by me. Russian nationals run it now. So that's super awesome. Yeah.
So why don't you guys just tell me a little bit about yourselves and what you do?
We both grew up in a cult called the Children of God or the Family. We were born and raised. We left in our 20s. It was a sex cult. They believed in sex with children. And
it was an abuse cult.
Yes, very abusive of all types, physical, psychological, mental. The leader died in 1994, and his wife took over the cult, and we both left in about our 20s. Whisper has four children. She's been divorced for how many years? Like 10 or something?
Yeah, more than that. Quite a while.
I was a single mother when I left with one child. We had a very rough, both of us had really rough times after we left. She nearly lost a child to suicide. My daughter was molested. I lost my niece to a drug overdose when she was 16. We had a lot of really rough times. I had a lot of drug problems. I was addicted to meth. I was addicted to pills. I was an alcoholic, smoked cigarettes. Wesper also was an alcoholic. March 10th will be 8 years for me to be not giving in to the substance abuse disorder. So we've conquered a lot. We've been through a lot and we suffered a lot. So we decided to start this podcast because we felt like we wanted to give survivors a voice. A lot of times the media likes to exploit our stories. Both of us have been in documentaries. I was in People magazine in 2019, but it was all we survived a sex cult and all of these kind of exploitive stories because they don't pay us for it. So we wanted to start something that gave people a way to tell their story the way that they wanted it told. And to talk about some of these things that are hard to talk about, that a lot of people don't want to talk about. And especially men, I really admire males that come out and want to tell their stories because it's such a low percentage compared to the females that are more open about their past. So
they're up against more culturally, they're up against more.
Yeah.
For sure.
That's the long and short of it. You want to add anything?
Yeah, just that we are hoping to steer some of the conversation towards things that, like Jemima said, are hard to talk about, such as mental health and some of the struggles that people face when they start over. The way that we were raised, we were not given a secular education or our jobs or anything like that. So when we got out, we started from scratch with a bunch of little kids, and some of the struggles that causes when you escape from a bad situation that you're in and you have to start from scratch. The realities of that is sometimes overwhelming, and people don't talk about that. They want to hear about the diddling kitties type of stories, but they don't want to talk about what it means to walk away from that and then start over. So the mental health issues, the starting over, and also the amazing resilience and beauty of anyone that has been through a difficult time in their life and come out on the other end, the things that they've learned, the person that they've become now, the things that they wish they knew, having those conversations as well, because it's very easy for people to, from the outside, look at survivors or people that are struggling through whatever it is and see them as broken or less than, when in actuality, like, most people that have been through that are more than. They have more to bring to the table in some cases than the average person. So having those conversations is where we were hoping this to go. We started in May last year. We've met lots of amazing people. We always walk away just absolutely astonished at our guests always.
We have listeners in over 800 cities right now. It's been exploding a little bit this year.
That's pretty crazy. I didn't even know you guys were... I had no idea. You know what I mean? Like, you don't really know anything about anybody until you sit down and talk with them. Like,
exactly.
I have some questions. I'm pretty sure you guys have answered these like a lot of times maybe, but...
No,
like,
go for it.
I've never even heard of that. Like that call. I know there's people out there that have those kinds of things, different parts of the world. I've never spoken to anybody that's been raised in a cult before. So like, how many people were involved in that?
Over 10,000.
10,000?
At one point, over 10,000. And it was all over the world. His whole kind of thing was to go all over the world. And that was what set us apart from most of the other cults that were US based.
Yeah. So yeah. When I think of like cult, I think like a movie where you're all living in like a colony together type of thing. Is that what it is?
Yep. That is exactly what it is.
We're all living in one area?
Oh, no, we would split up, but we would have
different colonies in different,
different
parts.
Yep. Yeah, we had up to 200 or 300 people at times living together, and then we had as little as 4 or 8.
But the majority of the time, it was very large. They believed in what's called one wife, which essentially is that there's no families. Everybody belongs to everybody. The children all belong to the adults. There's no husbands and wives. The small nuclear family was broken down very often and regularly. So we were both 12 when we got sent away by our parents. And yeah, that was the last time either of us ever lived with our families.
So did you guys know each other like growing up? Or were you in different parts of the country?
Yeah, both. We met when we were about 14 and 15. And we've been close friends ever since. They've tried to break us up. They tried real hard. but our love hung on. And then once we got out, just through over the years, we had lots of different times and experiences and always come back to each other in some way or another. So yeah,
that's like it's like your kindred sisters.
Yeah.
Yes.
For sure.
So how does it work now today? Is that cult still up and running? Is there still members?
It's mostly online now. They only have 1,500 like reported members now, and they just do like missives type of things, and it's a lot of online.
It's like an online church more.
Yes.
They
don't have like the colonies anymore or anything like that though.
No.
That's good. No. Did any of them end up going to jail or anything like that?
Very few. Only 2 or 3. And it was a big deal. They just put out a documentary not long ago called Children of the Cult. And it had a bunch of our friends, some people that we've interviewed on this podcast, that told their stories of how they actually tracked down and prosecuted their abusers. But the problem is that most of it happened in other countries and with the statute of limitations. By the time we realized that we were abused, it was too late to report it. A lot of places, it's like by your 18th birthday or 19th birthday or something like that. So
they should change it to like Canada's regulations. I think there's no statute of limitations in Canada.
Should that's be like what that we need. Over. Yes. We at least on abuse.
That's pretty crazy though to just imagine that kind of upbringing. Like, I can't even put into words the amounts of pain and turmoil and suffering and confusion I could just imagine as a child, because that's all you're surrounded in. That's all you know. You don't get to go to a public school. You don't get to do the things that other kids could have had. And things that I've learned growing up, like being an adult now, a lot of the things that happened to me in my adulthood were a reflection of things that happened to me in my childhood. Like why I was so messed up as an adult was because of the things that happened to me as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of studies and papers and things that I've learned about addiction is that it all stems from some sort of or form of childhood trauma. And nobody gets away from it, whether it's like neglect, whether it's like abuse, mental, physical, emotional, whatever type of abuse that it is. Some kids go through everything. And they're just like meant to like swallow that and keep that with them their whole lives. I commend you for breaking free.
I'm glad that you guys
are doing this, doing this podcast now, that you guys are sharing your story, because that's what it's about. It's like exposure. If you never admit there's a problem or like even find it, how are you supposed to create solutions for it?
Exactly. Yes. And that's another big thing is we want to show people that you can talk about it and you should talk about it, because otherwise these people are just going to go on doing this to other people. If we don't expose them and put a stop to it, they're just going to carry on with their lives and just keep on abusing. And then there's just going to be more and more victims. As we can actually stop that from happening, we got to take our power back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's not just in a cult sense either.
No.
It goes towards other things too.
Taking the shame out of these things that need to be talked about. It's so important.
Yeah. So your podcast basically is about awareness of not just like the cult situation, but awareness towards like empowering people to share their stories type of thing.
1,000%. Yes.
Yes. Very well said.
Just wanted to be clear.
Thank you. That's awesome.
Want to hear stories, want to share stories, want to empower people to find the courage to share their stories.
Yes. Wow. Yes. That's great. That's exactly it. So you grew up in Canada. You're a part of the Cree tribe.
There's different types of Cree. Just there's different types of Dene. There's different types of people in BC, like Coast Salish and Haida. There's so many different varieties of Indigenous people all across Turtle Island. Even in the States, there's so many different types of natives over there, too.
You know? Yeah.
So they try to put us in a bubble. You can't really do that. It's like saying one European person is the same as that person. You know what I mean? Like, we're all from different parts of this country and we all belong to different tribes. But I live in the Treaty 6 territory of Canada, which is in Saskatchewan, Nehewin, Nehiyaw, Cree, the Treaty 6 people. Yeah, my reserve is Sturgeon Lake, Saskatchewan.
That's beautiful.
The way I found you was from a post that someone shared that you had written about parents partying and children growing up in that kind of atmosphere, waking up in the morning with beer bottles and cigarettes everywhere and all of that kind of stuff. You want to tell us a little bit about your story and how you got from there to here?
All right. It all started on January 24th, 1989.
Oh, and you were born.
You recently had a birthday. Happy birthday.
Yeah.
So the way it goes, I guess my mom was pregnant and her water broke when she was at Bingo. You guys are Bingo in the States?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she stayed. She didn't want to go to the hospital right away. It was almost the end of Bingo. She stayed. She ended up winning, she said.
No,
she went to the hospital after. And I was born in the wee morning of January 24th, 1989. And it was a Tuesday, I believe. I can't remember. I was pretty young back then, but I'm pretty sure it was a Tuesday. Her and my dad didn't work out. Not compatible. Just a lot of toxic situations. I think before I can even share my story, I got to share a little bit about them. Because without them, there's no me. My mom grew up in a toxic environment. She lost her mother to suicide when she was only 6 or 7 years old.
Oh.
So she grew up without a mom. She has 6 siblings. Pretty sure there's 6 of them. They all got separated. Their dad wasn't really capable of taking care of them. So they ended up getting sent to live with different family members. And she ended up living with her auntie. Rebellious child, I would say. Dealing with a lot of issues. Things that were happening to her as a kid. She got sent to group homes and foster care and residential school. And I don't know if you guys know about what residential schools are over there. I think they're called boarding schools over there.
Okay, yeah.
So basically what they did was they apprehended Indigenous children, forcibly placed them into these schools where they were not allowed to speak their language. They're not allowed to practice their culture. They're not allowed to pray in their own way. They have to follow the rules. And a lot of them were physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, and sexually abused. My mom didn't share too much about the things that happened to her as a kid. She held it inside. She wasn't the type to really share those stories, probably because the shame, like things you guys are talking about, like afraid to, what if people don't believe me type of thing.
Yeah.
They recently found over 1,000 bodies,
yes,
different locations in Canada at these schools where these kids died in mass amounts and they were put into mass graves. So a lot of these kids, over 100,000 of them, went to these residential schools across Canada where they suffered through all that type of abuse. And a lot of them didn't make it. They're still searching for bodies at every location. They're going to start looking at every school that was in Canada. They have these machines, I don't know what they're called, but they can basically scan the ground and they can figure out if there's things underneath.
LiDAR.
And that's how they're finding these bodies there now. So there was an uproar here in Canada not too long ago when they discovered those 215 bodies in Kamloops. And ever since then, it's brought back that pain. The history of Canada is full of a lot of shame and people don't realize and understand the reality of what it took to make this country what it is today. Even the States too. This was all Indigenous territory before colonizers came to this area. And without the help of Indigenous people, they wouldn't have survived. They ended up going to the East Coast of Canada. and they migrated this way towards the west. And that's why we have these treaties. I don't know if you guys have treaties in the States. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But we have treaties set in place. Like I said, I'm Treaty 6 territory. So along the route of the creating Canada to what it is today, they had to implement these treaties where they stated you would receive this amount and this amount and we'd help you this and that. But a lot of those treaties have been broken over the years. A lot of those promises have never been held accountable by the Canadian government. And what they did was they tried to eradicate us as a people with those schools. So they tried to kill our culture, kill our language, mm-hmm. kill our spirituality, reform us, assimilate us, conform us into becoming something that we're not. And what that did was it unified all of us as Indigenous people across this land, because they didn't realize we're giving you all the same pain and the same hurt, and that's going to allow you guys to feel something together as a whole. So regardless of how terrible these schools were, they did bring us together. And a lot of the pain that my parents suffered, their parents, and so on. I can go back at least 7 generations in my family on my mom's side that have been involved in some institution where it was foster care, group home, residential school. And that cycle ends with me, children. You know, I put an end to that, and I said to myself, like, my daughter will never go to a foster home. She's 14 years old. She was born on January 23rd, and she's down the hall from here. Back from school. She's been with me since she's been a baby, and it's amazing to see that change happen within my lifetime, because I shouldn't be here. Like, technically I should be gone. So that was my mom's upbringing, and my father is very similar to her because he went to those schools as well. He has 12 siblings. Like, he has a big family. They were raised in northern Saskatchewan in Buffalo Narrows, and a little tiny like hut. Basically, I've seen pictures of their home where it was just like dirt on the ground. They would sleep in rows, like straight up campers, like trapper type of people living in that environment. And him and his brothers, like a long time ago, it was very unheard of for men to share their feelings, for them to speak or even say how they feel, you know.
Yeah.
To express such a simple emotion such as love, like even look at the mirror and say to yourself, I love you. Was probably something very hard for men back then to even do. But my dad is the manly man. You know, he doesn't express himself to this day, and he's still walking a path that's, you know, killing him. He's damn near 60 years old, and he's still, like, stubborn. He's like, stuck in his ways. But it took me a long time to realize that I cannot control him, cannot change his life for him. It's not my job to change another person's life. I can't enable people to continue to hurt themselves.
Yeah.
I can be there for them to talk to. I can do these things, but I need to take care of myself before anybody in this world. Otherwise, my life will fall apart and I'll end up right in the same spot you are. And it took a while to get to that point. So my parents separated when I was younger. They didn't work out. My mom ended up finding another boyfriend not too long after. Very abusive man. They would party a lot. They would drink a lot. People, random people, all times of the day and night. It used to be weekends, and all of a sudden it was the weekdays. And like that post that I stated, that's like only one situation of something that I've been involved in as a child growing up. Being passed from back and forth from my mom and my dad, and they're both addicted to whatever it is that they are doing at that time. And that's the kind of environment that Indigenous children across Canada live in, especially the ones that are stuck in poverty with parents that are addicted to drugs or alcohol or gambling or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
Addictions come before the children, and it shouldn't be that way. So I remember my mom and this man, they had a son, my little brother. And he was just a small baby at that time, but I remember waking up and I could hear like glass smashing, and startled me. I woke up. I was probably only five years old, maybe. And I could hear this man like beating my mom. And this isn't uncommon. Like, this happens a lot where my mom would have bruises on her face or body or whatever. But this night seemed to stand out from the rest of them. And I remember hearing my mom getting dragged around the living room, and you could hear, I don't know if you ever heard somebody get punched in the face before, but like that sound of like that smacking, and you hear my mom like struggling. And you hear my older sister, she's, leave my mom alone, get off her, and hear more glass smashing, and then it's just quiet. I hear the door slam, I guess my older sister ran away. And the whole time I'm in the bedroom with my little baby brother holding on to him. I'm a little kid, scared, crying. And it's just quiet now. And I could hear this man is dragging my mom's body to the kitchen. And he was heating an iron. That whole time that it was quiet, he was heating an iron. And I just hear my mom let out this really loud, like high-pitched scream. That man started burning her on the back of her legs with that iron. And, you know, like 30 years ago, irons, they were different. Even now today, if you heat one fully, like it'll burn you. So she ended up getting really bad third-degree burns on the back of her legs, and they had to take skin grafts from other parts of her body to fix her leg. He damaged my mom a lot. Like, he broke her clavicle bone. He ruptured her eardrum. Oh my God. Like, scars on her body. Like, just the abuse that she endured. And I remember the cops, ambulance, and fire department, and police officers, and social workers, and all these people come to our little tiny house, and they're all surrounding my mom. You hear the man, like, trying to escape, and the cops chasing after him. The social workers come into the bedroom with the ambulance, and they're checking us, looking at our bodies, and they're trying to take us out of the house, and I'm looking at my mom on the ground, and I'm like, Mom, help me, Mom. These people are trying to take me. And she's just laying there, like, not really paying attention to anything that's going on. She's just delusional from what just happened to her. And we get taken away. We get placed in the foster care. I remember walking up to the steps of this building in the middle of the night, and these people are like, they have to give you a bath right away, and they put bug medicine in your hair, like lice medicine shampoo. And they, like, put you in clothes, and they just put you in a bedroom. However old you are, you go into that bedroom, and so you go to sleep. All these thoughts are going through your head as a kid, like, what's happening? Like, where's my mom? Where's my sister? Where am I going to end up? What's going to happen now? And I don't know if you guys have ever felt alone or lonely as a child, and you just, like, can't hold back your tears and you cry yourself to sleep. And you cuddle up into a little ball and you just cry, and you're all of a sudden you're sleeping, you know, and you wake up. So I wake up the next day, and I'm looking around, and it didn't hit me until I was an adult looking at all these other kids in here. And now that I'm older, I realize and I remember now, like, all of them were brown. All of them probably lived through some situation just like I did. You know, all these indigenous kids. And you get put into one foster home. They keep you for a week or so. And all of a sudden you get sent back, get put into another temporary foster home. And every time you keep going back to this house, there's other new kids that keep coming. And since I've been a child, there's 20 plus of those houses all across my city that house these kids until they find either permanent homes for them or temporary homes for them. So by the time I was going on 10 years old, I'd been in and out of foster care so many times. I understood the system. I've been in over 30 foster homes as a child. That's different elementary schools, different families, different towns, different, you know, like, parts of my city. And it's a lot of instability that a child faces. And it's, man, it's just so, you don't get roots. And I feel like children deserve to have foundations set in place for them where they can build and grow from.
Absolutely.
As a foster kid, you don't get that. Like,
yeah.
You have so much uncertainty about where your life is going, and you want to be like the rest of these kids. And man, I was in some houses that were just terrible, that just should never, they should never be allowed or anywhere near children. Some of the things that I do today are because of things that happened. Like, I chew my food differently now. It's weird. I remember I was in this one house, and something as simple as this, but, like, just sitting there, and, you know, I'm, like, scared. It's a new home. I'm trying to eat my little Cheerios or whatever cereal it was, and I'm, like, chewing my food, and then all of a sudden just, boom, big smack in the back of the head. My little cereal goes flying everywhere. And the lady, the foster parent, is like, chew your food. Like, chew your food normal. And I'm like, I don't know how to. What do you mean? Like, how do you chew your food normal? So I, like, I eat differently. Even like my partner and my wife here, she was telling me, like, you don't have to eat all your food on your plate if you're full, stop eating. But as a kid, I was in poverty so often. I didn't know when I was going to eat next. I didn't know if I was going to have another meal. So I'd eat as much as I could in the fear of not being able to eat again later. And those types of little small things like that carry with you throughout your childhood.
Oh, yes,
so
for
there
sure.
was like, there was a lot of places that I went through that. I never wish that on anybody to have to feel or go through those types of pains as a kid. But there was also like a few good places I went to that showed me that people actually do care. There was a family that now lives in Casper, Wyoming. They genuinely cared about me, but at the time I was so guarded because I'd already lived in how many like foster homes by that point. I'd already had so many social workers by that point. I'd had so many principals, teachers. Like, have you guys ever watched Free Willy?
Yeah.
Me and my wife, we just watched Free Willy not too long ago, and it triggered that memory in my head where he's like, what are you going to do? Go ahead and dump me. I'm only here for a little while anyways. Like in my head, I'm thinking like, I'm not here forever. I'm going to go to another foster home anyways. It got to a point where I had this mask on where I was like scared and sad. But you don't want to show people that all the time. Like eventually the scared and sadness turns into an anger, like a fighting back kind of mentality. Like you're not going to hurt me. So I had that guard up when I moved in with these people. And they were nothing but kind to me. You know, they showed me like how to love again. I remember crying and just being held by this foster parent. It was such a kind feeling that I hadn't had since I lived with my mom as a smaller child. You know, and I miss that affection. And that's what kids really need and deserve is like a hug. You're going to be okay. You know, you're awesome. I really love you. You know, like just hyping that kid up it does wonders for them. So I got that with these people that taught me how to ride a skateboard. I didn't really do too good. I freaking fell on the sidewalk and scraped up my whole nose and chin. I never rode the skateboard again after that. They gave me a bike. I started riding with the training wheels on, learning how to ride around that little cul-de-sac. And one day they took the training wheels off. Now I'm riding all down the street by myself. And I know I'm looking at them. Hey, he's all happy, smiling, clapping, cheering on. Like those good memories I have with those people. And eventually like, I get a call from the foster mom. She says, Michael, come here. And I'm standing there with her in the kitchen. And she says, we got a phone call from your social worker and it's about your mother. And she wants to set up a visit with you. You know, like, how do you feel about that? And I'm uneasy, you know, like I haven't seen my mom in a while. But deep down inside, I'm like, I really want to see my mom, but I'm scared. So I say, you know, I shake my head. Yeah, okay. So we go to the visit. I'm sitting there waiting in this like room and the social worker is sitting there with me and I'm nervous. And all of a sudden my mom walks in and she's holding like a toy, like a little Ninja Turtle toy or whatever it was. And I just run up to her. I don't even look at the toy. I just grab my mom, just hugging her. I'm like probably up to her waist at this point. We're crying, we're hugging, we're laughing, we're talking. I'm sitting there and playing with these toys and the social worker sitting there taking notes. And then all of a sudden, it seems like the time just flew by. And they're like, okay, Michael, the visit has to come to an end now. And I'm like, no, start crying. Why can't I go with my mom? Look at her. She's healthy. She's okay.
Yeah.
That's not how it works, Michael. Like, you need to go back with your foster parents and we'll set up another visit with your mom. And I look at my mom and she's like, I love you, my boy. Don't worry, like I'm gonna see you again. And she reassures me. So I go back to these foster parents and when's the next visit? Every day I'm asking, can I talk to my mom? All you want as a child is to be around people that love you.
Yeah.
So my mom starts calling more and more. All of a sudden my foster mom is, you know what, Michael, I think we're gonna have to stop these calls with your mother, because every time my mom started calling it was getting later. And her voice would slur and things would change with her and the background of her phone calls. So my mom started partying again, started drinking again. And then I go to the next visit, waiting. I'm super excited. I got those butterflies in my stomach. My heart's pounding. I just can't wait to go and hug my mom. And the social worker comes inside. It's not my mom. I'm like, where is she? And half an hour goes by. Still remember that your mom can't make it today. Why? Well, she probably got hurt. I'm thinking like the worst like scenario of what happened to my mom. I don't think it's her fault. And then I go back to the foster home and the phone calls continue. Sorry, my boy, I missed the visit. Something happened. The next visit comes, same thing. She doesn't show up. The next visit, she doesn't show up. And then finally that last visit, I just say, I don't want to see her. She doesn't even want to see me anyway. And I'm like 6 years old at this point, and I already feel that resentment towards my own mother. Like, she doesn't care about me. Why should I care about her? And I'm okay with these people. And I have this attitude that, I don't know, just a really toxic love-hate relationship already at that age.
Yeah.
So my mom like goes to treatment and she tries to fix her life and, you know, make things better. And we get the visits back on track and it gets to the point where I get to go home and visit her at her house and spend the weekend with her. And she ends up getting drunk while I'm there and she has an alcoholic seizure. I don't know if you guys have ever had those really bad hangovers where like you're just shaky and you can't like function and you literally need alcohol to like make yourself feel better. So she ends up having a seizure and the ambulance come and I had to like pull my mom's tongue out of her mouth and roll her on her side. And I don't know how I knew how to do all this at that age, but, you know, ambulance come and police come and they notify the foster mom and they take me and I don't get to see my mom again after that for a long time. Uh-huh. So she continues on that journey. Dad, on the other hand, wants to take me out. He wants, you know, like to be a part of my life. And he decides, you know, like we're gonna move to Vancouver in British Columbia. So we take a long 2-day Greyhound bus ride all the way to Vancouver and met a new woman. And that's another thing that I've learned from my dad over the course of my life so far is like how to have an unstable relationship with somebody. Because I've seen people from one relationship to the next. And I feel like a huge part of that is because he doesn't love himself. And I would say that he deserves, you know, the best. And you set it to the less than he deserves. So he would always go into these relationships that would seem okay. Honeymoon phase is over. Then boom, toxic, alcohol, drugs involved, whatever. Breaks up, doesn't give himself time to heal, grow as a person, onto the next relationship. Continuously giving himself. You know, he's a person who always has to ensure other people's needs are met before his. It really affects him if he doesn't live up to people's expectations. So he's really hard on himself in that sense. So fast forward now, my dad can't handle me. I'm back in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. My mom is trying to take me again. I get sent back to this foster to that place that I was speaking about when I first went to foster care. I get sent back there. Mm-hmm. And then the people that are there, I'm like, hey, can I go back and live with these people? Because, you know, like, I don't want to go to another home. I want to live with them. They were really nice to me. They're like, we'll call and see if they want to take you back. And sure enough, they're like, of course, we love Michael. You know, we'll take him with us. And I go back to them again. And I'm thinking, you know, I'll probably end up living with these guys for the rest of my life. And it almost happened. You know, it got to the point where they took me all the way to Wisconsin. They had a family out there, did a big road trip from Saskatoon all the way to Wisconsin. They didn't have to take me. They could have sent me back. So they wanted to adopt me. My mom would not sign the papers. She kept fighting for me, leaving me, fighting for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And my mom and my dad took me out of foster care. Well, my dad technically did. So I lived with my dad when I was about 9, almost 10 years old. I got out of foster care. I started living with my father and I would see my mom sometimes on the streets and her alcoholism got to the point where she started to drink hairspray and Listerine and like rubbing alcohol, like things that would get her drunk. And she was like that person that would come up to you on the street and be like, you have any spare change? And they just look and smell like, you know what I mean? Just rough. And that was her life and that's what she became. And I got really resented her for a long time, but I still loved her deep down inside. That was my mom. I didn't care.
Yeah.
So 10 years old, I'm a rebellious little child. I've lived through so much. I've endured already more than any other adult I know that's been through this kind of lifestyle. So I start hanging out with the bad kids that have lived through similar situations like me. And we start off doing a little bit like stealing from the store, like bubble gum and chocolate bars or whatever we could fit into our pockets. And eventually that escalates and it leads to other things, right? Like smoking cigarettes and eventually trying marijuana. And when I travel and I speak and I share my story, I can't stress enough the importance of the role models you have around you, the people that you look up to that help guide you and shape you as a young person. Mm-hmm. Those people leave a huge impact on the way that your life can turn out. So we all have cousins, we all have friends that are usually older than us or siblings, and we look up at them and we say, well, I want to be like you. So if your role model listens to like rock music, then you're probably going to listen to rock music. If your role model listens to rap music, you're probably going to listen to rap. Father listens to rap. He listens to Tupac and Biggie and Bone Thugs and Harmony and old school 90 rappers. And that's the mentality that I started to carry. You guys know what NWA is? That group? Rap group, NWA? Can't say the word, but it's the N-word with attitude.
Okay.
And I used to say, I'm a native with attitude, living with that mentality now. So I'm following my cousin, and he's my role model. So he shows me, like, hey, Mikey, do you want to get high? Do you want to smoke a joint? I'm like, hell yeah. You know, like, I've been waiting for this day to come. So I'm like 10 years old, smoking this joint with my cousin, and I'm just like high out of my mind. I don't know if you guys have ever smoked weed before, but the very first time you do it, I don't know what it does to your brain, the chemical reactions that happen, but I was like, ooh, I'm on cloud number 9, and I get hungry. I want to go home and eat, and I eat everything in the fridge and cupboards, and I fall asleep, and I say, I want to feel like this again. I want to feel like the next day. I didn't realize what I was doing was what exactly, like, my parents did before me, was I started suppressing emotions. Because when you're high, you don't feel, right? Like, you don't feel how you're supposed to feel. You start numbing yourself with different types of things, and that's where addictions comes into play. So a lot of people don't want to feel the things or remember the things that have happened to them. So that's what I started doing every day. I'm 10 years old. I'm addicted to weed now. But nobody hires 10-year-old kids to go work, so you got to steal to provide for your addiction. So this is where the toxic relationships start happening, because you're stealing from the houses, you're stealing from whatever you can do to get that money to feed your addiction. It starts to escalate and grow and evolve into worse things. Now he asks me, hey, do you want to get drunk? I say, yeah, you know, like, I never drank before. But as a kid, I remember saying to myself, I'll never be like my mom. I'll never be like my dad. I'm never going to be an alcoholic, because you don't plan that shit when you're a kid. People come to school, what do you want to be when you're older? A lot of kids are like, I want to be a rocket scientist. I want to be a dentist. I want to be whatever. You don't hear a little kid, I want to be a prostitute. I want to be the best dancing member in the world. I want to be an alcoholic. Like, we don't say that stuff when we're kids, because we want the best for us. 10, 11, 12 years old, those years were really rough for me as a kid, because my environment was just full of prostitution, drugs, violence, gangs, like all of these negative things that you could think of was what I was surrounded in as a kid. And my older sister that ran away that night when I was a kid, when I got taken to foster care, she was only like 12 years old and she was already a prostitute.
Oh my God.
She'd lived through the situations that I lived through, and she just handled things in a different way. And she's the only oldest sibling I have left. So that leads me to the next point. My role model, my cousin, he looks at me and he says, do you want to try this other stuff that I have? And he's only like 14, 15 years old, and he's sticking a needle into his arm.
Oh my God.
And I'm 11 years old, and I'm like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to. Inside, I'm like, no way, I don't want to do that shit. And he's like, come on, you just check it out just once. So 11 years old, he sticks that needle into my arm. He injects me with, I don't even remember, I think it was like morphine or some kind of down. Instantly, I just boom, hit the ground. Like, I feel like I'm just out of energy. I don't know if you guys have ever done that type of drug before, but that was the first and last time. First and last time I ever did it, I remember watching like the blood come out, go back into my body. And as soon as the needle leaves you, it's like this hits you. And I'm like, oh, I just felt sick. I forgot to mention my dad kind of got sick of my attitude of stealing and doing all that kind of stuff. So he sent me to live with my sister, who was that 12-year-old. She was now 15, almost 16, and she already had two kids.
Wow.
She was raising me, and my other cousins were now living with us too in this small 2-bedroom apartment. So I didn't even make it back to her house. I ended up going to my dad's house, and I fell asleep on his couch for 2 days, and he didn't even know. He doesn't even know about this story. Like, these are things that we just don't like to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I almost died. I could have died. That would have been my story right there.
Yeah.
The creator has a plan for all of us. And I guess mine was to survive and share these stories with people. And when I share my story and I share that part, I always speak of the importance of what one time, one experimental time can do for you in your life. Because some people would love that feeling, and I'm the person who hated it. But for the people who love it, they're going to continue to do that the same way I did with weed and alcohol. And that's what my sister chose. That's what my sisters and my cousins chose. In the last decade, we've had over 10 deaths in my family of immediate cousins. So my one sister, my cousin that lived with us during that time when I lived with my sister as, you know, 11-year-old, She just recently passed away on December 25th. On Christmas Day, she passed away from an overdose. My older sister, Tracy, passed from an overdose. My auntie, Randine, my cousin, Joy, my sister, Demi. Like, the list goes on and on of these really close family members of people in my generation that I grew up with are all gone now. We're down to 13, less than 13 of us now. And there's only one of us who's lived to be past 60 years old so far. My aunt is almost 60, and she's the only one, I think, that's past 60 years old in her generation. So our life expectancy as Indigenous people is already low as it is, but with the drugs and alcohol factored into it, we're not living very long. So that was the first and last time I did needles. I did not like it, and I never went back to it ever again. But the alcohol was there for me. The weed was there for me. My role model was constantly around me. We're stealing, we're fighting, we're doing crazy things, walking around with knives and stabbing people at that age just to get money. And one night we took it too far. We found these two boys and we ended up beating them to the point where they were on life support. And we almost killed them. I ended up getting sent to jail not too long after that.
Wow.
Sent close to 2 years in jail. So when I was 12 until I was 14, I was incarcerated in youth facilities across Saskatchewan. And that's not unheard of here in my city and other cities near me in Canada for Indigenous children to be in that kind of lifestyle and to grow up that way. Such an ugly feeling. I don't know if you guys have ever been to jail before, but like, it's such an ugly feeling to take that freedom away from somebody and what it can do to you mentally as a child. I remember I didn't want people to pick on me because I was pretty small when I was little. When I was 12 years old, I wasn't very tall or like muscular at all. I was a little skinny, scrawny kid. And I got into a fight and I got sent to a room confinement. It's called like isolation type of thing. So you have to stay in your room, you know, the whole time. You can come out and use the bathroom, that's it. So I got sent to like almost 30 days in my room. And every time a guard would walk by, I was like, F you. And you get 24 hours extra every time you swear at the guards. It's another 24, Michael. I don't care. F you. It's another 24. I don't care. Adds up to a month in solitary confinement. And I'm like, 2 weeks go by and they're always passing by my door. And I'm always like just peeking over the window. I can barely even see. Hey. What, Michael? I'm sorry. I don't care. You got to finish the rest of your time in there. So that month goes by and I'm like, I never, ever want to go into solitary confinement again because that doesn't, it's like the worst feeling.
Yeah.
Taking your humanity, you're like an animal basically is what it is.
Yeah.
And it makes me so sad to know that those jails are still populated with Indigenous children, men, women. In Canada, actually, women make up more than half of the percentage of females that are incarcerated in federal and provincial institutions. Our women make up more than half of the people that are locked up today. Our men make up roughly 40%, which is almost half. Our youth make up like more than half of the inmates that are locked up. So we're going from residential school, foster care, to the jail system, and it's a never-ending cycle that creates a lot of money and revenue for the governments of this country and that country. And a lot of jobs would be lost if these Indigenous populations started changing their ways and waking up. And sometimes I feel like it's a systematical, I don't even know if that's a word. I don't know if it seems like it was planned for this to happen to our people. Could just be me, but a lot of the research and work that I do now within school is like pointing in that direction that they wanted us to not succeed. So it's unheard of for like men my age to live a sober life and do the things that I do, which is ridiculous because my ancestors didn't pray and sacrifice their lives for me to go and destroy my life. They prayed for me to succeed and be healthy and be happy and carry those traditions and that culture and keep that alive. That's what they wanted for us. So as I got out of jail, I transferred and I transitioned back into the population, you know, and my mom really made a big drastic change in her life. She put down alcohol for good. She stopped drinking. And it was so weird to see her like live like that because all I've ever known of her up until that point was just alcoholic. So I get out of jail and my sister goes into jail. So she gets sent to 4 years and we start raising her kids. So they're just young now. They're older now, but at that time, we start raising her. I go to high school. I don't know. I skipped grade 8. I got arrested in grade 7. I got out, and I was going into grade 10. I never graduated kindergarten. I never graduated grade 8, and I never graduated grade 12. And now I'm in university, so I've never got to experience a graduation. So
that'll be
excited.
Fun.
I'm excited. Yeah. I got my degree, and like, I did it. This is all good
times. Yeah.
So now I'm in high school, but I don't pay attention. Like, I'm that goofy kid who just wants to fit in, wants to belong. And that's what a lot of kids are surrounded in. My daughter just started high school this year. She just started at a new school not too long ago. And she's so different than me. We're so similar, but we're so different. Like, she has such a good head on her shoulders.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't want to credit myself because she's her own person, but like, she's had so much more opportunities and stability than I've ever had. I think the longest we've ever spent apart from each other in her whole life was like 28 days. When I went to treatment, that was it. The longest we've ever been apart. I love to see her grow and evolve. And I feel like a lot of people compare themselves to other people. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of people who post stuff online, it's just their highlight reel. Look at how awesome my life is. We share our highlights, our good things.
Yeah.
I don't. I like to share the negative side and the reality of like how life is, because I don't want people to look at me and think I have such a glamorous life. You know, yes, it's a lot better than it used to be, but it took a damn long time to get to where I am today.
For sure.
Like as addicts, we just like, boom, we're so used to an instant relief, you know, whether it's off of a smoke, drink of alcohol, smoke weed, whatever it is, we expect it instantly. And when you become sober, it doesn't happen like that, man. It's such a long process, and it's so much harder because you actually have to feel everything you've been running from your whole life. And that's what makes a lot of people fall back into it. Getting ahead of myself in the story here, but go back to the high school part. So I drop out of high school at 17 years old because my daughter, the person I was with at the time, ended up telling me she was pregnant. So we ended up having my daughter. But a lot of things happened within that time. So I ended up overdosing at the age of 17 on cocaine. Ended up in the hospital, and as like heart murmurs or as irregular heartbeats and stuff like that because of it. And it was like, it was at that point where I got really suicidal now. Like, I stopped eating. I used to have really bad anxiety and panic attacks. And it got to the point where I was fearful to fall asleep. Like, I would say, if I fall asleep, I'm never waking up again. So I'd stay up for like days until I was just groggy and couldn't keep my eyes open physically. And I'd fall asleep. I couldn't even drink water. Like, I would drink it and I'd spit it out because I had a fear that I would swallow it and I would choke on the water and I would die. I couldn't chew my food. I couldn't swallow my food. So I just chew it until it was like mushy and I just spit it out. So I got really skinny, got really sick, got really unhealthy within a matter of months, and I lost a lot of weight. And then that cocaine thing happened to make it worse. So now I'm at the point where I don't even want to be alive anymore. I just want to die. And then I asked, you know, God to give me a sign, almost taking myself out of this place. But I got the message. I went to go see my daughter's mom at the time. And she ended up telling me she was pregnant. And inside, I was scared. But I don't show people that anymore. I'm this tough guy now. So I show anger. In my head, I'm like, I'm going to be like my dad. I'm going to be like my mom. I'm going to be a failure. Like, I started doubting my ability to be a parent before, you know, she was even here. So I slammed the door. I started walking down the street and she's, come back. No. Like, come back. I'm like, fine then. And I go back. What do you want? Like, what can I do? Like, it's too late already. Like, this is happening. She says, how do you feel? Like, what do you mean? How do I feel? Like, what if I'm like my dad? What if I'm like my mom? And I just started like saying all these things out loud. She says, like, do you want to be like your parents? I said, no, be that for your kid. You know, and I think that's up until that point, that's probably like the most that I've ever talked to another person about my feelings. So it kind of like felt nice to like get it out, to say it out loud. So we fast forward to the day 23rd, 2008. Her water breaks, and I'm so excited. I can't believe I'm gonna be a dad. And looking at her, hold her in until tomorrow. It's my birthday tomorrow. Have her on my birthday. You can't tell a pregnant woman to hold a baby. And so, January 23rd, 11:33 a.m. My daughter was born and brought into this world, and I got to like hold her, and it's. I can still remember the feeling of looking at her for the first time and just seeing that image in my mind. Of everything else just went black. Just me and her, and I'm like, you're never going to a foster home. I'm always going to be there. I love you. It's a feeling I've never felt for another human. Like, I love you so much. Like, I would die for you. Like, I would legit die for you if I had to. So I got blessed, and that was God's way. That was Creator's way. You know, you're here. Here's your sign that you needed. I don't know if people are atheists, whatever, but everybody has like something that they believe in, whether it's like a God, Creator, whatever it is that you believe in that works for you. I used to pray for really dumb things like, please God, let me be water, let me be rich or whatever, like just stupid stuff. But now I just say, like, my prayers are different now. They're like, thank you. Something as simple as thank you. Like, I made it out. Thank you for the life I have today. Thank you for my child. Thank you for just little things like that. And I also say, please send me a helper today. Send me a messenger today to help guide me on this path. And little things will fall into your journey, that something as simple as like a bird will just, they'll land there, they'll look at you and they'll take off. That could be one of your ancestors. You don't know. That could be that message that you were looking for to continue going on this path. Because a lot of us feel like giving up a lot of the times, and we don't say it.
For sure.
We don't say it to people. What's the first thing people, hey, how are you doing? Whisper, how are you? And you're like, I'm okay. How are you? You know, but deep, I don't know what's going on with you. What if today or yesterday or last week, what if you felt like giving up? The first thing that we normally tend to do is just say, we're okay. So we reflect, and we don't project what's wrong with us to other people, because we don't want to put that pain on them too.
Yeah.
People who've survived and struggled and lived through really torturous situations, we don't want other people to feel our pain. So we hold it inside so good that the world doesn't even know what's wrong with us. That's why this podcast is so important for people to just express themselves. And that's what it's about, is just saying what's wrong, so we can find solutions for each other to make our lives better. Had I had somebody like who I am today teach me back then, my life would have been so much better. But I was stubborn. I was angry. I was confused. I was lost. I was neglected. I was all of these negative things. And I played the victim card for so long. Things kept getting worse before they got better. And usually that's how life goes, because we have small moments where we can be happy. And that's it. And the rest is just all shit. We're trying to get back to that happy part. So after my daughter was born, it wasn't too much longer. The federal government of Canada basically said, we are sorry to all you Indigenous people for putting you in these residential schools. We're going to give you a bunch of money, and that's, we'll be okay now. So all these people that were in residential schools got a bunch of money, and all of it was gone within a year. You know, a lot of them were addicts who got that money. A lot of them drank it away. They bought new vehicles, crashed their vehicles, sold their vehicles, whatever. But that money was gone. The pain was still there. You can't fix problems with money that go that deep. It starts so much deeper and further than that. So my mom ended up getting hooked on needles. She got really sick really fast, and we went to a big argument. I didn't want to talk to her for a long time. And finally, she got to the point where she was skin and bones. My mom was like 70 pounds. Like, you could literally see like her temples and her eyes were sunken in. And she ended up getting really sick and put into the hospital. I committed her because I didn't want her to leave the hospital. I wanted her to stay there and get better. And I told her, like, up during that point too, I was drinking way more than I normally did. It was weekends. Now I become the alcoholic who's putting my daughter in dangerous situations. So, like, cops came knocking my door a couple of times. Lucky my daughter wasn't there, or she would have got taken to foster care. So that's where my life was heading. Now I'm drinking every day as much as I can, because I don't want to face the reality that my mom is dying. So I go and see her, I take her to the hospital, and the doctor's like, it's really good you brought your mom here, because her potassium level is so low that she could, her heart could just stop beating. We have to get her on medication. They admit her, they take her in there, and they keep her. And I look at my mom and say, you're safe, mom. You're okay now. I'm going to come visit you tomorrow. I'm going to stop drinking today. I'm going to work on getting the kids back. Like me and my mom, we raised my sister's kids, like I was saying. And they got taken to foster care. And that's a really touchy subject. That was a really hard point in my life to lose those kids because they were like my own, you know? They got placed in the foster care and they grew up in the foster care system. I feel really responsible for that, but at the same time, they were living with my mom, who was really toxic, who was leaving needles under their bed, and like just a really bad environment. And I felt like if I left them there, things would have happened to them that shouldn't have happened. So I made the choice to have them sent away. And that was a bigger part of the disagreement me and my mom had before she passed, was like that. But at the same time, now that I'm older, I realize like it was for the best. So fast forward to my mom being in this hospital now, really sick. I made the promise, I'm going to get the kids back. I'm going to, you know, fix our lives. You're going to get better. I'm going to stop drinking. And I do. I keep my word. The next day, I don't touch the alcohol. I poured whatever I had left in the sink. I go to this building downtown here in my city, and they help people find jobs and signing up for all these programs because they have a lot for Indigenous people here to get work and stuff like that. So I get signed up and I'm all excited, and they're like, yeah, come back this day and you're going to have your interview. And I'm like, okay, awesome. I go visit my mom. Guess what, mom? Like, I talked to the social worker. We're going to have a visit when you get out of the hospital. We'll get to see the kids again. I haven't drank since this day. I have a job interview tomorrow. Like, I'm just hyped up. I'm pumped up. Like, yeah. Life is getting better, mom. That's good, my boy. That's good. I go visit her all the time. We'd always go outside, and she'd have a smoke in her little wheelchair, and she'd sit there and smoke. Okay, let's go back inside now. I go see her. Guess what, mom? I got an interview tomorrow. Awesome, my boy. Let's go inside and have a smoke. And she's sitting there smoking. I'm sitting there smoking with her. And let's go inside. She's like, hold on. She's like, I just want to have just one more smoke. Just one more. I'm like, okay. And I'm trying to talk to her, but she's like really distant. Like, I'm thinking, what's wrong with her? She's looking way over there and I'm here. And she's not even acknowledging that I'm here. I'm like, okay, mom, let's go inside. She's like, okay. So I take her in a wheelchair, and normally I just lift her up and put her on her bed like she's really light. And she's like, I don't want to lay down. She's like, I just want you to put my feet on the edge of the bed. Cover me with a blanket. I'm like, okay. So I lean in and I give her a hug from behind. I love you, mom. I'll come see you tomorrow after my job interview. She looks back. She's like, I love you too, my boy. See you later. That's a big thing. My mom would never, ever say goodbye. Like, goodbye, mom. Don't you say goodbye to me. It's never goodbye. Like, see you later. Wake up next day. I'm all excited and happy. Life's better. I don't got the shakes no more. I'm not getting really sick from this alcohol. I got a job interview. I'm going to see my niece's nephew in a few weeks. And I'm in my interview now, and my phone just like, just constantly vibrating. And my answer, my little sister, Mike, she's just hysterical. What's going on? You have to get to the hospital. Mom's dying. Like, what are you talking about? I was just there. I don't know. Call the doctor. I call the doctor. What's wrong? What happened to my mom? What's going on? He's like, your mom fell out of her bed and she ruptured her kidneys and her spleen. And you have to come in. We have her on life support. We resuscitated her 2 times. There's nothing we can do for her. Come and say goodbye to your mom. I'm like, man, my heart just sunk into the pit of my stomach. And my brother's in his interview. Come on, man. We got to go see mom. I need to get to the hospital right now. Like, what's wrong? Are you okay? Like, I'm hysterical now. I'm like, it's okay. It's fine. I'm sorry. We'll have to reschedule. And we run across the bridge. We get to the hospital. Where's ICU? It's down the hall. Let's go. We start running to the bedroom. I run to that door. And I can see my mom's name on that board thingy. And she's laying in this hospital bed, and she has all these machines hooked up to her face, and they're breathing for her, keeping her alive. And I'm just like, I don't want to believe it. Like, I'm in denial. That's not my mom. Let's go. Let's get out of here, bro. And I've never seen my brother cry before. He's not even my real blood brother. We grew up together, and I call him my brother. He said, go see mom. She needs you. And I go in. Grab her hand, but I don't want to like look at her face. She waited for me to come in, talking to her, and I'm like, bro, come wake up mom, man. I told her she wasn't gonna die in here. She was really afraid. to go to the hospital. She thought she would die. And then I was like, you're not going to die. You're going to get better. It'll be okay. And, you know, her worst fears coming to light. And my worst fears coming to light. And trying to call all these people. Like, come to the hospital. Come to the hospital. My sister's still in jail. Trying to get a hold of anybody in the jail. Like, I need to talk to my sister. Our mom is dying. And finally, I get my sister to call and say, what's wrong, Mike? What's wrong? Mom's dying. So this is the last time you're ever going to talk to her. And I put the phone by my mom's ear and I just hear my sister is crying. Like, I'm sorry, Mom. I love you. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. My sister says, and the phone cuts off and now it sets me off. And I'm like, wake up. And they took all these machines off her. Now my mom's she's just fighting for her breath and she can't breathe. And I'm just like, I don't want to let her go. That's my best friend. I couldn't keep her. It was her time. To make matters worse, she lived kitty corner of me. From where my apartment was, my window, I could see her window. So I had to go home. And every night I'd just stand there. I'd just stare out the window and look at her window. And before, like, I could look out there and I'd see her. And she'd wave at me, like, come over. Now I'm looking out there and I'm just like, I wish I could see you. I wish I could hug you. Every time there's a Mother's Day or there's like her birthday, you know, just special days. Like I don't get to see. She never got to see me today for the way that things turned out and how I changed. And it hurts to know that I don't get that anymore. But at the same time, I'm happy she doesn't feel pain anymore. And I didn't take it like that. Back then, I was against everybody. When she left, I died inside. I started drinking way more than ever in my life. I became the alcoholic now where I wake up with the shakes. Like, I end up in the hospital. I start throwing up blood every day because my kidneys are, like, failing. My esophagus lining is ruined. Like, I'm destroying my body with this alcohol and I'm developing cirrhosis of the liver at the age of 21. That's how intense my life became after my mom passed away. And I was losing it. I didn't know where to turn to at that point. And I prayed to God. I just prayed, help me. That's it. Like I told you guys earlier, the simple prayer, just help me. This one guy asked me, hey, do you want to go to treatment? I'm like, nah, man, I don't need treatment. I'm good. I'm an addict in denial. I'm okay. I'm going to be all right. I'm fine. Turns out I actually needed treatment. And I took the opportunity one day, but I was really scared to go. I get to the treatment center and I'm like half snapped still from the day before. You're supposed to be sober 4 days before, but I didn't follow the protocols. And I get there and I'm a little asshole to everybody. Like, where the hell is everybody? Like, everybody in there is old, like 40, 50, 60. And I'm like a guy in my 20s. Like, these are just old people. Like, I don't want to be here. And I'm a jerk every time. I don't know if you guys ever been to like AA or NA or anything. And they're like, my name is Mike and I'm an addict. And you share a little bit about your life and pass it on to the next person. Every time I'd be like just sitting there like this, just closed off. Like, my name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic and pass. And I let the next person talk. And then the group leader person is, today we're going to talk about childhood trauma. And I'm like, you know, I'm thinking that's so stupid. I don't have childhood trauma. Like, I'm in the wrong place. Everybody has childhood trauma. I'm like, nope, not me. Goes around to me. My name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic. Pass. Come on, Mike. Share a story. You never talk. What do you guys want me to say? I don't know. What happened when you were a kid? I don't know. I went to foster care. Why? I don't know. My mom drank. Why? I don't know. Like, why you guys keep asking all these questions? It's starting to piss me off. And they're just trying to, like, make me say things that have happened to me. And I start talking about it. And this is the first time in my life that I ever talk. I take up the whole time we're supposed to talk. And I'm just like, tears. And I'm like, boo, this snotty, ugly, crying face. And I look up and I expect everybody to be like, oh, I can't believe this guy. Like, share. Like, I'm afraid people are going to shame me and for saying what I said. But a lot of them were crying with me. Of them come up to me and they hug me and thanks for sharing that. You know, like I went through something like that too. And I'm just like, I don't feel so alone now. Uh-huh. And about a week before that, I was like contemplating leaving this place, man. Like I legit went up to my counselor and he was on the phone. I'm like knocking on the door. She's on the phone. What's wrong? What do you want? So like, I don't want to be here anymore. See the door? Leave. It's like, hold on. She's like supposed to tell me to stay here or something. I'm like, no. if you don't want to be here, then go ahead and leave. Like, you're taking up somebody's spot who needs to be here. You want to like go back to that life? Go ahead, go and suffer some more. Holy shit, go suffer some more. You're supposed to be a counselor, man. You're supposed to help me. How am I supposed to help you if you don't want to help yourself? Go suffer. It's like, holy, okay, I'll leave tomorrow. They called my bluff. I thought they were going to stay here and get better. But it wasn't like that, you know? Like, I go up to my room and just look in the mirror and I'm just mad, but I'm sad. And I thought about what she said. Go suffer. It's like, man, I've been suffering my whole life. I don't want to suffer no more. So I look in the mirror, and after that class where we learned about our childhood trauma, they were like saying, start saying nice things to yourself. Start being kind to yourself. I don't know how to be nice to myself. Just hang up little notes in your room and stuff. And I remember that next week I wanted to leave, and I just looked in the mirror and I was like, help me, send a messenger. And the next day, a new group of people came, and two young people came. I was like, yes, finally, some people my age. A young guy and a young girl, and I go run up to them. My name's Mike. What's up, man? Let me show you guys around. And I'm all happy and excited. And me and this guy, we become really close friends. And we have this workout area in there, and we're just like working out. And I like to like bench press, and I'm like lifting this. Like, I'm way bigger, not way bigger, but bigger than him. And I have this weight on there, and I'm like, ah, and I'm lifting it and put it on the bar. And I tell this guy, take some of that weight off. Like, you can't lift it. He's like, I got this, man. He starts putting on more weight, and I'm like, all right, maybe he'll surprise me. And I go around the corner, and I'm like working on. I get this here, and I'm like all pumped up for my testosterone. Get it, bro. Get it, man. Lift those weights. Trying to hype each other up. And then I get this here, help. The whole time he wasn't even like lifting it. It was just stuck on his chest, and he was like, lift it. We get it off, and we just started laughing. Holy shit, man. He almost died. I know. And we just like solidified our friendship, but. Near death experience. So I go back to working out, and he's, damn, bro, you need to learn to love yourself. I'm like, what? Like I'm not trying to fight him, but I'm like, what'd you say to me? Because holy man just said learn to love yourself. But my mom ended up telling me that when I was like 15, when I got my heart broken, learn to love yourself. And one ear and out the other, but as an adult, it comes back to you in different forms. So I'm in my room after that session where I was crying my eyes out, and have these little notes in my room, and just like little things that are gonna uplift me and make me feel better. And I look in the mirror and I'm like, man, I've been through so much shit. I've been through so much. And I started, I could feel the tears coming in my eyes. I'm like, you're still here, man. I love you. It's like, thank you. Thank you for not giving up, man. I love you. And it's like, I love you. And like, I feel love for myself for the first time in my whole life. And I've never felt that before for myself. And I'm just like screaming at the top of my lungs, and we have like thin walls in the treatment. They're, shut up, man. Love yourself tomorrow. Getting ready for like bedtime. So after that moment, that clarity of finding love for me is where things are like, boom, I know what's possible now. Because I love myself. Things are going to start changing for me now. I start putting more time and effort into being into this place, and I start to fix all the wrongs. I realize I do have a lot of childhood trauma. I have a lot of things that I need to fix about myself to become healthier and happier. And like I said earlier, it doesn't happen overnight. I'm proud to say coming this August 8th will be 10 years, a whole decade that I haven't done drugs or alcohol.
Wow.
Since that time, I've done a lot more with my life than I have. The first 2 years of that time, I've done so much more. In my whole life, I got to go to Hawaii. I got to go travel to all these communities across the country and the states. I got to share my life with thousands and thousands of people. And it's because Creator has a plan for each of us. Some of us, we have to go through a lot of really dark times to make it to that light. But it becomes our job to now go back into the darkness and bring as many people out as we can. And that's where the change begins, is with you, you know. Your podcast is going to help a lot of people. Whoever's listening today, thank you for paying attention to some of my story. You know, I hope that it inspires you. But my journey is far from over. I have a lot more to give to this world. And it starts with me creating a better life for myself. And people want to be motivational speakers. I would advise you to, you don't have to live a dark life to share a positive story. You could just find the greatness in any situation that you're faced with. And I believe that no matter who you are, rich, poor, you know, man, woman, young, old, you are always going to encounter some type of negative situation, whether it be the death of a family member, maybe you lost your job, maybe you got your heart broken, whatever the situation is, mm-hmm. happening for a reason. You have to realize that this moment you're in right now does not define who you are, because there is so much more that is going to happen in the future. So don't give up on yourself today. Don't feel like throwing in the towel, because you have to remember that Creator gives his hardest battles to his strongest warrior. We believe that all of us are warriors. You might be struggling. We don't, you know, until you share that with the world. But you have to remember that you aren't alone in that struggle. You're here with a lot of people who have lived through similar situations. And I feel like it's our duty as human beings to help make life easier for other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So be kind to yourself. Be kind to the world around you. Respect and love and learn and grow and achieve and dream and believe that things are possible, because that's what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
Inspiring others to achieve and be successful.
Thank you for coming on. It's been really nice getting to know you and hearing your story. It's amazing.
Yeah. Seriously. We're some we're some mad warriors here.
Straight up.
Yeah. But like you said, though, the most important thing is breaking the cycle. Don't let it continue. It can stop. It can stop with you. It it stopped with us.
Yeah.
It's not easy, though.
No, it's not.
Anybody out there that's listening, just be prepared to shelter yourself with that armor. And when I say that, build your spirit up through whatever it takes to make you more mentally stable, emotionally, physically, spiritually stable, because the temptations are going to come. Mm-hmm. The hurt is going to come. A lot of the negative things are going to come. And you're going to have to deal with it without drugs or alcohol, and it's going to make it worse and harder. But you'll find solutions to those problems.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
You will. Exactly. It doesn't happen overnight.
No, it doesn't.
I'm going on 10 years. I still got a lot of problems from back then that I still have today.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lifetime of healing.
Exactly. It's all about getting to know yourself too. Really looking at yourself in the mirror. Don't lie to yourself. Sometimes we like talk ourselves into things. I do this a lot, right? Okay, this thing. I don't know. That's probably not so great. I could. It's not that bad. And you get that whole kind of talking yourself into something. Does that make any sense? We have to be honest with ourselves about who we are, and then be willing to put in the effort to change it. And
yes.
To make ourselves better for the future generations. And sharing our stories, I think, is a really powerful way to pass on the things that we've learned. Like you said, now we've come out of the darkness and we got to pull the other people out. And that's what our podcast is all about. It's like being the people that we wish we had when we needed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I get a lot of questions after when I'm done my presentation, and a lot of them, they're in regards to like role models or like people. How do they get away from these situations when they're living in it, when their parents drink or the people they live with drink? And something I tell them is, you're not going to be there forever. So start creating that foundation for yourself. And like you just said, you become the person that you don't have. And I didn't have any friends when I was sober, when I first got sober. A lot of people were really angry with me. Oh, you think you're so much better than we are now because you're sober? And I said, no, man. I don't even want to be better than anybody. I just want to be better than who I was yesterday. It has nothing to do with you. It's just you have no place in life today. It doesn't make me like you any less. Like, I just want better for me. And if you don't want better for you, then we can't be friends. Because true friends aren't going to help me kill myself. True friends are going to help me build my spirit up. Real friends are going to help you become the best version of yourself, basically. So be careful with people you surround yourself with, man. Not everybody wants to see you succeed. A lot of jealousy and anger can come from the people that you least expect it.
Because it shines a spotlight on them. Sometimes I get angry at someone because they're doing something that I know I should be doing or shouldn't be doing, whichever way it goes. But that's sometimes what it is. They don't want to see that reflection.
And everything you say is the things that we've been saying, or the things that we're thinking, or the things that we need to hear.
one little short story that I wanted to share. Have you guys ever heard the story about the two wolves?
No.
No?
I don't think so.
Okay, so
Andy's heard it.
There's these two wolves, all right? So there's one wolf that's anger and jealousy and negativity and all the negative things that you could think of in the world. That's what that one wolf is. And then there's another wolf that's full of hope and inspiration and love and kindness and all of those good things in this world. So one's negative, one's positive. And they're both trying to get your spirit. Every single day that you're alive, these two wolves are fighting inside of you. They're trying to gain control of you. Do you guys know which wolf wins?
The wolf that you feed will win.
Mm-hmm. Give in to that anger, to that jealousy, to that negativity. That's what your life will become. But if you give in to the kindness, if you keep feeding hope and love and light and positive and the good things to that one wolf, to that light wolf, your life will become those things. So that's what you got to continuously do, is just not be better than anybody. Just be better than who you were yesterday and your life will become better. Create goals. Once you complete that goal, create another goal. Do all the amazing things that you were born to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good. So good. Excellent. You're very wise beyond your years for sure.
Yeah, I'm like a little Jedi.
Yeah. You're just swinging that sword around.
I'm like Obi-Wan Kenobi right now.
You're getting there.
But I just wanted to say thank you guys for inviting me to be a part of your podcast.
Thank you for joining us.
Really grateful for the opportunity to share some of my life. And I'm really happy to hear some of your guys' life stories too.
Cree Customs.com.
Yeah.
It's like clothing. It's like positive. There's stuff like The Sober is Sexy. There's stuff like Creator gives hardest battles to his strongest warriors. Cool. You know, positive affirmations, that type of stuff. Iconic Native people on there, I guess. I'm still working on it. More focused on school than anything right now.
Yeah. That's awesome. Awesome. We'll end this like we always do. Stay brave and remember that every butterfly was once a caterpillar.